welcome to DNA Today. I'm your host, Kira Deneen. DNA Today informs you on what's happening in the genetic world, shows packed news stories, lessons, all to keep you updated and educated on the ever-changing world of genetics. You can tune in Monday at 11:30 a.m. to hear me live on WHUS.org or on the radio, 91.7 FM. And today I'm lucky enough to be joined by Robin Swartz. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
She's an assistant professor at UConn Health and a hereditary cancer genetic counselor in the Genetic and Genomic Science Department. She's received her bachelor's degree in biology from Herbert H. Lehman College and her master's degree in genetic counseling from Rutgers University. She's a member of the National Society of Genetic Counseling since 1979, and she was a coordinator of clinical genetics at Columbia University, researcher associate at Rutgers University, and has been at UConn Health since 1987. So she's really been in the genetic counseling field for a long time and has seen a lot of changes, and she's going to share with us a lot of what she's experienced through the years. So I want to start with how genetic counseling provides patients. So what can people expect to gain from going to a genetic counseling session?
So going to a genetic counseling session is really important if people have concerns about their family history. And so they may have a family history of neurologic problems, they may have a family history of cancer, which is the area I work in. They may have a child who was born with a specific inherited disorder, and they'd like to know more about their the condition, as well as how that may have implications for other family members. So people typically come if they have concerns about their own history of health concerns or family history. And going to a genetic counselor can help really try to evaluate whether or not going to a genetic counselor really provides them with an opportunity to address all of their concerns about the condition, how that could affect them, how it could affect family members, and also give them an opportunity to gain information about resources that might be very beneficial for them.
So what are some of these red flags that people can be mindful of when it comes to family history of cancer?
So when it comes to a family history of cancer, the red flags include early onset cancer, cancer that may occur in multiple family members, individuals who have themselves been found to have early onset breast or colon cancer, for example, have a higher likelihood of the cancer being an inherited form of cancer. Having said that, though, I just want to sort of throw out there that most cancer is not inherited, only about 5 to 10%.
5 to 10%, it's that
inherited.
Small.
But the reason it's so important to pay attention to those red flags is that the management guidelines for people who have an inherited form of cancer can be very, very different from those who have cancer based on a sporadic occurrence. So getting back to red flags, early onset, multiple affected individuals with either the same type of cancer or cancers that may occur in what we consider syndrome or pattern, such as breast and ovarian cancer in the same side of the family, especially when it occurs in the same side of the family with the early onset breast cancer. Early onset colon cancer, for example, multiple individuals who might have multiple polyps in their colon. So age of onset, rare cancer, and multiple individuals are the biggest red flags.
So if someone thinks that they are eligible for genetic counseling and that they could really benefit from it, how can they set up an appointment? Do they need someone to refer them, or can they do it themselves?
So most of the time, people come to see us because they've had a conversation with their healthcare provider about their personal or about their family history. So very, very often people are referred by their primary healthcare providers or by a specialist. For example, someone being evaluated for early onset breast cancer may be referred by their surgeon or their medical oncologist. Or another source of referral are people, women who are seeing their OBGYN. Their obstetrician, their gynecologist, who takes a good family history and updates their family history and finds out there are things that might be of concern. But we do have people who call our office who have just questions themselves and set up an appointment. So some of that is insurance-driven, so the subtle kind of nuance is, yes, we would talk to anyone who came to see us, who wanted to come see us, but in fact, everyone should be very mindful of their own health insurance requirements in terms of whether they in fact need a referral or a referral is required by their insurance.
Now, insurance companies have a variety of different rules and regulations on coming to see genetic counselors, what's covered, what's not covered.
Right, exactly. So it's always the person's responsibility to find out a little bit more. But a lot of people call our office because they really don't know what to ask their insurance company.
Right.
Because your insurance company is a little less familiar, for example, with some of the subtleties of inherited cancer compared to someone calling up and saying, you know, I need an x-ray because my arm was broken, you know. So it's all very...
It's a different kind of field.
And so we, you know, our office does try to help people and educate them and inform them kind of about what the counseling session may be and what they have to do before they come.
So when patients are getting educated, do you have a lot of patients come in that have the agenda of, I want genetic testing, that they've done research on their own and they're looking for you to kind of help them get there?
Mm-hmm. So it varies. It varies a lot, but there are certainly people in, you know, who come with that perspective. There's a lot of information and very good information that's available on the web, and there's information available from organizations that people may be involved in, such as, you know, an ovarian cancer foundation or Facing Our Risk of Cancer and Power. So people often come with information. They may have read things before. And, you know, another big effort of genetic counselors is education of other healthcare providers about what genetic counseling can provide and how it can help their patients and how it can help them manage their patients' risk. So often they will hear about our services from their physicians and with, you know, with enough information so that people feel comfortable coming. But there are probably people who don't feel that comfortable coming, and because it's something new and different, and something they haven't experienced before. So we really make a very very. We think it's really important to make an effort to, when people call, to schedule appointments and really inform them about, you know, what we can do for them.
And one of the things you can do, we mentioned, is genetic testing. Now this is a scary thing for some people to find out if they are positive for a certain mutation in genes. What do you advise patients when going through genetic testing of the consequences but also benefits of going through genetic testing?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So when we think about, you know, when I think about genetic testing, I think that, you know, if we put it in the context of a test that might help manage risk or might help allow us to say that there is less of a risk, it's really a conversation about, as you mentioned, the benefits of testing, and then what their perceived, what our patients' perceived burdens are or concerns are. And so really when we see someone in our clinic, we try to address that right away. In fact, the question that I typically ask people when they come in, first thing is, what brought them in? What brought them in, and whether they had any additional concerns. And very often they'll tell me that, for example, you know, I've known about my mom's test results for 2 years and I know I'm at a higher risk, but it really took me a while to really get my head around like that. I wanted to really know the information. And that's very appropriate. So people who have really thought about this and come to a comfortable place with it is great. But I also really enjoy working with people who are not exactly sure that this is something they want to do. Because I think as a genetic counselor, we can really, really help people kind of go through their thought process of what they have concerns about, what their fears are. Sometimes their fears are founded in fact, and sometimes their fears are founded in fiction. And so it's really important to for us to get to know them as a person and really understand who they are, who supports them, you know, emotionally, where they go to for their information generally, and then really get a sense of how we can help them make a decision if they're conflicted. You know, what are the things we need to talk about so that they're clear whether they decide to have a test or not have a test.
So how do you decide which genetic tests to pursue?
So we have, so I think that would be a good place to talk a little bit about how genetic counselors are very, very well trained, because our background includes a 2-year commitment, a master's degree, where we learn, where we take courses in physiology, we take courses in genetics, we take courses in molecular biology, we take courses in biochemistry. And so we take we have a lot of experience in our genetic counseling programs in learning counseling skills and helping people set an agenda and how to do research and how to understand the best ways of looking for sources of good information in the medical literature, for example. And so we have a really, really broad base so that we can evaluate an individual's family history very, very thoroughly. We can access up-to-date research information. We know how to analyze the medical literature. And all of that knowledge brings us to the place where we can answer an individual's question about, based on their family history, what test to consider.
Because it really does vary. It's not clear-cut.
It requires a significant amount of evaluation to determine which test to do. Because it's really important to do the right test on the right person in the family to get the most information in terms of helping people manage what their concerns are, and also helping their healthcare providers obtain information that's useful. So, for example, when we see someone who has, we'll use a personal history of early onset breast cancer, there could be a number of genetic conditions that can be related to. And so we look at what's in the family history and in the personal history and determine whether there might be a specific syndrome involved. So most people have heard about hereditary breast and ovarian cancer syndrome, in which individuals carry mutations in the genes BRCA1 or BRCA2. But there are other inherited breast cancer syndromes beyond BRCA1 and 2 that we also will evaluate on many of the people who come to see us, especially now that testing with panels of genes, sometimes it's called parallel testing because we're testing more than one gene at the same time instead of going gene by gene by gene to try to find an answer. And so we look at all of those elements and try to determine what the best test is. And that's not just based on kind of what our sense is, but there are guidelines through the National Comprehensive Cancer Network where we can look at the specific diagnostic criteria for those particular conditions and then evaluate the family history based on that as well. So that's a good guide. That's a very important guide for us.
That most genetic counselors are using to decide which genetic test to go forward with.
Correct.
So you have some genes that you're testing for, say, breast and ovarian cancer. Now, 5-10 years from now, or even less than that, there may be new genes that have been discovered that are associated with these.
Mm-hmm.
If someone has had genetic testing in the past or even recently, what should they keep in mind for the future?
So an individual who is evaluated because of a personal history of cancer and has a positive test result, at least at this point in time, we consider that's a test result that certainly isn't going to change with time. So I want to reassure your listeners that if someone or they know someone with a family history and they've had a positive test result, that the newer advances aren't very likely to change that. But that individuals where we have not been able to kind of get the answer, there's new information that keeps emerging, so that as a technology emerges, we're sometimes able to find areas of the gene that were difficult to test before. So if we're thinking of a condition called Lynch syndrome, which is involved in inherited colon cancer, where the age of onset of colon cancer is typically younger than the average age of colon cancer, individual families may see multiple people with colon cancer in the family, and they also may see other cancers such as endometrial or uterine cancer, renal cancer, pancreas cancer, ovarian cancer, and cancer of the small bowel and stomach cancer. In that condition, there were two genes that were known to be associated with Lynch syndrome for a very long time that accounted for about 90% of Lynch syndrome families. And as time went on, more other genes were discovered. There are now 5 genes, and even within the testing panels, some panels of testing may not include some variations that we're now learning about. So it is important for two reasons to contact your healthcare provider and your genetic counselor. One, to update your healthcare provider and genetic counselor if there are additional issues that have come up in the family since the prior time that the individual was seen, as well as inquiring about whether there's additional testing that might be available. And so we always tell people that if their test is negative, that in some situations, and they have a personal history or a significant family history, we tell people to give us a call in a year or two and just, you know, ask whether there's anything new available as well.
So when someone goes through genetic testing, what are the different results that they can have?
That's a great question. So when someone undergoes genetic testing, they can get a result that's positive, they can get a result that's negative, and they can get a result that is a variant of uncertain significance. There are five actual categories of types of mutations that our society, genetic societies have sort of come to understand. And on one hand, there may be variations in the genetic material that are benign. So this would be a negative test result. There are variations that are pathogenic. And then there are some where they look like they may be likely benign. There are some that look like they may be likely pathogenic. And there are some that are just uncertain because there's not enough information that is available for the individuals doing research trying to classify variants to know for sure. Because the answer has to be, the answer really has to be very, very accurate in order, to help us guide individuals' risk. So the variants of uncertain significance can be numerous. The more genes that we test, the more likely there is to get a variant. And so in the counseling session, we tell people that if they have a panel test, if they had a panel test for 49 genes, they're more likely to get a variant of uncertain significance, or VUS. And that's very, very important to include in your pre-test counseling session.
So if someone has a positive test result, how does this change their risk for developing cancer? And I'm sure it's different between different cancers.
It's very different between different syndromes. So a positive test result. So what we do is, in our practice here at UConn Health, my colleague Jen Stroop and I, as much as possible, like to see people back for follow-up, so we can sit down and talk about their test results, because their test results really need to be viewed in the context of their family history. So if a family member comes in and has another family member who's already had genetic testing that was positive, most times, unless there's a family history of other concerning issues on the other side of the family, we would test for the presence or absence of that one particular genetic finding, right? And so in that situation, when the test is positive, we can be very confident that the test result is compatible with a specific genetic syndrome. And so the various options for people include increased surveillance, sometimes chemo prevention, and for some genetic conditions that involve cancer risk, risk-reducing or prophylactic surgery. With respect to the genes BRCA1 and BRCA2, the difference in our assessment with respect to cancer risk is fairly well established. Individuals who carry a BRCA1 or 2 mutation have a 50 to 87% lifetime risk for breast cancer, compared to the general population risk of about 1 in 9, or 12%. And the risk for ovarian cancer in the general population is less than 2%, but for individuals who carry a BRCA1 or 2 mutation, the risk for ovarian cancer is about 25 to 40 or 50%, depending on whether the gene is BRCA1 or BRCA2. BRCA2 carries a somewhat lower risk, towards the 25% range, compared to BRCA1. So with that, management guidelines are different, and it's really important to take into account where the person is in their life with respect to their age, with respect to their reproductive planning, with respect to where they're living, what kind of access they have to healthcare, and really try to coordinate with their healthcare providers a team that can address all of those concerns.
So what, if someone has a positive result, how does it affect their family members?
Mm-hmm. So in most of the inherited cancer conditions, the conditions are inherited as a dominant condition. And so with that, individuals who carry a mutation in a hereditary cancer predisposition gene their test result has consequences or implications for other family members, and so their siblings would have a 50% chance to be a carrier as well. It is pretty likely that it was from either their mom or their dad's side, and their children have a 50% risk of also inheriting the same cancer predisposition gene mutation. So 50%, just to be clear, is not their individual family risk for cancer, it's the risk for inheriting the gene mutation.
And when you're testing someone, why is it best to test the person with the cancer as opposed to maybe their children?
Mm-hmm. So in general, right, if we have a family and people are in contact with each other, we do recommend testing an affected family member first. So remember what I said before about most cancer not being inherited? So if we think about that, right, if I tested any person who came into the office who had colon cancer, there was about a 5 to 10% chance that they might have an inherited predisposition. There are a lot of different genes that we would test because in addition to Lynch syndrome, there are numerous other syndromes that include a higher risk for colon cancer. So if we test an unaffected person in the family, it could be that their negative test results great news, but we don't really know whether the colon cancer risk in that family was due to an inherited predisposition or not, unless we know the test results of the affected family member. Does that make sense?
I think it does, yeah. You want to test the person that actually has it as opposed to children because they're the one that is more likely to carry the mutation and pass it along
mm-hmm.
to children.
Right. And then getting into testing of children, that's a really interesting question because in most inherited cancer conditions, the cancer risk for children is not there, doesn't occur, with some exceptions, syndromes like familial adenomatous polyposis, which is abbreviated as FAP. In that situation and in some of the inherited paraganglioma conditions, for example, testing children is appropriate. There's also some endocrine conditions where there's thyroid cancer that occur even in very young children, so there it's very appropriate to test family members. But the difference is that we want to evaluate families and children as well when there are management guidelines that say that really include intervention to prevent cancer in children.
You don't want to really test a child unless you need to for their childhood years. It's better to wait for when they're adults.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because it is an adult decision. As you mentioned before, some people have fears about genetic testing, but it's a management guideline. You know, and if management guidelines don't really change management from the general population until someone is in their 20s, then it is very, very appropriate to have that individual make their own decision. And we also worry about families that know that their children are positive for something that you really can't do anything about until later, and how that could affect an individual's feeling about their children or feeling about their vulnerability, and you know, set up some difficult family dynamics.
Definitely. So you've seen a lot of changes in the field of genetic counseling. What are some of these changes that have been happening over the last couple decades?
Well, that would take more than a half hour, probably. But I think from my perspective, I'm going to answer that in two ways. One is that the field of genetic counseling has grown tremendously. And the kinds of services that we can offer to individuals in so many different areas of medicine is really fabulous. So I can talk about areas in terms of cancer genetic counseling that we talked about today, but also in the area of, say, cardiovascular genetics and cardiac risk. There are another group of conditions where we can specifically identify individuals who might be at risk, who might benefit from implantable defibrillators to help prevent life-threatening arrhythmias and sudden death. So we can really figure out who in a family may be at risk and who's not, and provide counseling for those individuals. We've also been able to establish links in the areas of neurologic disabilities and, for example, certain types of conditions that cause early onset dementia, things that cause difficulties with walking, difficulties with neuromuscular disorders. And really the key to understanding treatment is understanding the biological basis of all of these various conditions. Because until we know, so the technology's advanced so much that we've been able to understand what the gene defects are and then study how they affect the proteins in the body, how they affect the muscles, how they affect the brain. And that is really the key to treatment, ultimately.
It's starting at that molecular base and going from there.
Right, right, right. So I think that is really the thing that's been very, you know, we hoped that would happen, and the technologies and the bioinformatics have advanced to the point where we're really starting to see some of the effects in the clinic with respect to diagnosis and treatment, and hope that area will be very, very fruitful in years to come.
We have a lot of student listeners, since this is a UConn program. Do you have any advice for them if they're going into the field of genetics or even genetic counseling?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's great that there are a lot of people who are interested in genetic counseling. I have to say that our office, and we have about 5 genetic counselors in our group, gets calls on a very regular basis from people all across the country who are interested in shadowing with us and understanding genetics. I think one of the best resources for students is our organization's website. It's the National Society of Genetic Counselors, and the website is abbreviated nsgc.org. It's a fabulous website that has a tab for students, people who are interested in the field. One of the things that was developed so that students can kind of get an idea of what a genetic counseling session is that there are recorded genetic counseling sessions on a variety of different areas. So somebody's done an interview with the patient with the perspective of really showing what a counseling session is, because I can talk about it as much as possible on the radio or even anywhere else. And, you know, until you kind of see the dynamics, you really don't have much better feel for that. So the National Society of Genetic Counselors is a really great website.
And they have a database on there of genetic counselors in the country, so you can look up who is in Connecticut, or if you're in California, wherever you are, that you can find genetic counselors.
Right. I mean, I think it's a great idea to take a genetics class that has a bent towards human genetics, just to kind of get a sense of whether that's interesting. I think it's a field in which the individual has to have a really good background in science and a really good background in counseling. And that all develops over many, many, many years of practice. But I think to understand and the field is very broad. So there's some genetic counselors who work in a laboratory setting and they don't see patients. There are some genetic counselors who work in public health. There are some genetic counselors who work in clinical fields. There are some genetic counselors who work for companies as representatives to talk about the tests that they offer. There are some people who are in private practice. So it's really, really very, very, very broad. Some is university-based, some is kind of smaller, non-university-based. So, you know, there are just a lot of different opportunities. Trying to talk to genetic counselors who are in your area or someplace, you know, where you go to school or someplace where, you know, where your home base is can be really, really helpful to try to get a better understanding. But I definitely recommend people go to our National Society's website. Our National Society of Genetic Counselors has been a fantastic organization, and it's been around since the 1970s, and it has a tremendous amount of resources for people.
Great, and I'll link that on the website. Website is dnapodcast.com. You can follow on Twitter at DNA Podcast. Thank you so much for coming on the program, Robin. We really appreciate getting a glimpse at genetic counseling. It's definitely not, you know, everything you do, but it's a great inside look.
That's great. Thanks, Kira. This is a pleasure.
Yep. You can tune in next week, Monday at 11:30 a.m. to learn and discover new advances in the world of genetics.